So we are up to the second factor of the Eightfold Path. So last time we finished off the right view, Sammāditti, this little book. So now we come to Sammāsaṅkappa. And you can see there's only just a tiny bit in here about Sammāsaṅkappa, but you know from my Dhamma talks that I make a huge amount out of Sammāsaṅkappa because it's really important. We've called it right thought. Is not quite the right word. Sometimes it's called right intention. This word actually, Sankappa, means almost like planning or preparation. So it's almost like where the thoughts actually come from. What you might call right motivation. So anyway, what now is right thought, Sammāsaṅkappa? There are the three right thoughts. Nekamma, Sankappa, Avayapada Sankappa and Ahimsaka Sankappa. And Nekamma means renunciation, letting go. It does not just mean lust. Lust is only a part of renunciation. So, what do you renounce? Everything. Will, you name it, you renounce it. But you don't renounce your mindfulness. You don't renounce precepts. So, in particular, the sorts of teachings which, this is where Ajahn Chah gets his teachings from, you meditate not to get things, but to let go of things. It's nekamma, to let go. See how much you can abandon. See how much you can get rid of, not trying to attain more things. As someone was talking today about, or a few days ago, about Chogyam Trungpa in his quite brilliant article about spiritual materialism, and there was a Tibetan monk who actually spotted that many people in the United States at that time, yeah, they had given up much, but they were really going for spiritual attainments. And it was a spiritual materialism which goes against the nekamma. So nekamma is all this attainment business, it's all part of me, myself, what I have, like getting more medals on your chest if you're in the army, or many badges if you're a scout, all that sort of stuff. It's not the opposite of nekamma. Nekamma is how much you can let go, how much you can renounce, how much you can divest yourself of. And the opposite is owning things. So it's not lust. It's much bigger than that. It's like craving to get things. So that's why when you meditate, remember, you're meditating to let go, not to attain some state of meditation, not to attain some state of enlightenment, but to see how much you can let go of that tendency of the mind to acquire things. Another experience. Let that go. Yes? It's in the opposite direction of craving. Craving wants to get more and more and more. And nekamma wants to get rid of things. So in your room, when you want to put something more in your room, that's called craving. When you want to throw something out, that's called nekamma. And now we're talking about your spiritual room inside. The next is the motivation, or the where you're coming from non-ill will, from avayapada. And as very often here, avayapada does not mean that there's no plan there at all. It means the opposite in this particular case. And what's the opposite of ill will? Metta. So this is like coming from places of kindness, opening the door of your heart to your stupid mind, opening the door of the heart to whatever's happening right now. And that is actually avayapada, ill will. And you can see in meditation, just so much ill will happens in people's meditation. Always trying to get rid of it. This is not good enough. I want jhanas. I don't like this state of mind. I don't want to do this. I want to do something else. And if you have that ill will, then your meditation is not going to get anywhere. Because it's wrong thought. And lastly, thoughts free from cruelty. Ahimsa Sankappa. Now, ahimsa is exactly the same word as ahimsa. You know, which was made famous by Gandhi, of non-violence. And that really is what it means. Not just cruelty, but non-violence. what I always say is gentleness. And so I've made a lot of that because it's very important to remember, especially when you're meditating, this is the Eightfold Path which leads to enlightenment. It's part of the meditation. To always make sure that whatever you're doing, you're letting go, you're being kind, you're being gentle. And then you're practicing the second factor of the Eightfold Path. Yes. It does, because as I said in that talk the other night, or about 9 days ago, 10 days ago, that whenever you things disappear, wow, you're free. I'm free of having to do all this stupid stuff. I'm free of my husband. I'm free of my work. I'm free of the kitchen. I'm free of all this other stuff. Oh, I'm so happy. You've let something go. Now that's only simple happiness. So when you let go of your body, oh, it's so nice to be free. So, in the jhanas, the first jhana, when you're totally free of the five senses, one of the descriptions of that happiness, the Buddha said, is nekamma sukha, the joy of this nekamma of renunciation. He said that's what you describe it by. You're blissed out, and you realize afterwards it's because you've renounced so much. You're just like a person who's been free from jail. You're out on parole in jhana land. When you go out of jhana, you're back in prison again. But at least you know what it's like to be outside.
Like renunciation, like, it can be, there's some wrong ideas I think about it. It's always like a final force to push things away, but it sounds like it's more like
leaving things failed, not going out there to get things. And have the whole attitude of the mind is in life, we're not here to acquire things. Because people in life, they acquire property. Now, when you're young, you've got to sort of get your house and you furnish it. And then, you know, when you've got your house and your furniture, then you've got to get your car. And if you really sort of get going, then you get your second house, and you get your yacht, and then you get your private plane. And people measure themselves by all the stocks and shares, by how much they possess. And the more you possess, you know, the sort of thing, the more successful you are. Look at me, I'm a total failure. I haven't got a car. I haven't got a house. I haven't got a bank account, I haven't got a wife, I haven't got any kids. No one loves me. Of course, many people love me. But you see, I'm going in totally the opposite direction of acquisition, seeing how much you can let go of. Now, you can see that's what we mean by nekamma. And that's physical. You do the same thing in your mind. So all the stuff which you own in your head, see how much you can allow to disappear, you let go. So remember, just every day when you get up in the morning, there is a rubbish collection. Take all that stuff in your head, put it in a rubbish bin, and take it out the front here, and the truck will come and take it away. Yeah, a soft waste collection. Yeah, who's first here? Go on. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Well, in other words, if you do nothing, you know, all the stuff which you own, it just wears apart, somebody else takes it, well, you're not guarding it. It goes back to nature. So it is true that samsara reclaims all your possessions sooner or later. And if you don't sort of keep doing things, you know, you lose things. So that's true in that sense.
But how is it like the
nature of samsara? Well, I mean, the thing is, because you don't really own it anyway. So if you have to always keep on, if you don't keep on asserting your ownership, someone else claims it.
It's like anicca, is that
the same as anicca? In the sense, yeah. It always changes and it's uncertain, it fades away. But it's true, you have to do something to keep up your ownership, right? Yes?
Maybe just to follow on.
Indeed, that's what happens. Sometimes people think they've got no ill will at all. They don't see it. But when you get into meditation, one of the great tricks there is you get so far in meditation, you can't get further, do some metta. A really sort of strong metta. And it's amazing how many times that works. And when it does work, it means you had ill will there. And it shows you that ill will is very, very subtle. And you know, sometimes it's ill will, you have an, even a beautiful nimitta, it's ill will towards it. Which means, you know, you just, I don't want this, I want the jhana. Get out of here, nimitta, I want something more. And it is ill will, that's why it doesn't develop. So it's amazing, you can have ill will towards the Buddha, the most beautiful, wonderful nimitta. You can have ill will towards anything. Yeah.
If you do that,
I say, well, yeah, because you know, it's your ill will towards it going.
Yeah. Control, ill will.
Yeah, it's actually ill will or goodwill. It's all will. So it's all a bit of control, but do the goodwill first of all. And that's always the type of letting go. And again, the gentleness. Again, is that third factor is very ignored. People think the meditation is like an army boot camp. You've got to be like a marine. And just get up 2 o'clock in the morning, you lazy bums. Especially when you're on retreat over in Jhana Grove just for the weekend. You can't afford to waste time. 2 o'clock in the morning and don't go to bed until 1:55. Come on, meditate or bust. And people try that sort of stuff and they do bust. So be gentle. Just like a Buddha. Now the next part. Now, what I thought I'd tell you is of two kinds. Now the Buddha never said this, as I'm going to read out in a minute, but I'm going to read this first of all. Thought free from lust, from ill will and from cruelty. This is called mundane bright thought, lokiya samasankapa, which yields worldly fruits and brings good results. But whatsoever there is of thinking, considering, reasoning, thought, ratiocination, application, the mind being holy, being turned away from the world and conjoined with the path, the holy path being through, these verbal operations of the mind are called the supermundane right thought, lokutra, which is not of the world but is supermundane and conjoined with the path. And that comes from the notorious Mahachatarasa Sutta, number 117. And I mention this later on, that this is very hard evidence that this was added. It was not the word of the Buddha. And I'll read this. This is actually a pre-publication edition of Venerable Analia, a German monk. I actually met him in Frankfurt. He came to have a discussion about meditation, about some of his work comparing the Pali version of the suttas with the Chinese Agamas. Because the Chinese Agamas, this is the Chinese version of the Sutta Pitaka, they came from very early sources, and they were translated into Chinese. It's very easy to translate back, because one word has one sort of ideogram, so it's very, very simple to retranslate it back to what the Pali would have been. And they're comparing these things, and they find some very glaring differences. So I'm now going to read the little couple of pages here of Analia's research into the Mahachatarasa Sutta, from where we get this mundane and supermundane nonsense. Another instance where comparing the Pali and Chinese versions of a discourse bring to light a noteworthy difference is the Mahachatarasa Sutta. The Pali version of this discourse examines wrong path factors and right path factors, and supermundane path factors. The definitions given to the same wrong and right path factors in the Majjhima Agama, that's the Chinese version, a discourse differs insofar as it does not treat supermundane path factors at all. That's actually, it's not in the Chinese at all. A quotation of the same discourse in Samatha Deva's commentary on the Abhidharma Kosa preserved in Tibetan also does not record such a treatment of the supermundane path factors. So it's in the Pali, but it's not in the Chinese or the Tibetan version of this same sutta. A closer scrutiny of this Mahacitarasika Sutta brings to light that the terminology, the words used to define the supermundane path factors is precisely the same, exactly the same, as the terminology used in the Vibhanga's exposition of the path factors according to the methodology of the Abhidhamma. The Vibhanga is one of the main first two books of the Abhidhamma. So they use the terminology exactly the same from the Vibhanga, from the Abhidhamma. Some of the Pali terms used in the Mahacitarasika Sutta when defining supermundane right intention as fixing of the mind, as mental inclination, are not found in other discourses and actually belong to the type of language used only in the Abhidhamma and historically later Pali text. So in the same way as I mentioned, you can tell whether the text is from Harry Potter or Shakespeare by the vocabulary. So even the vocabulary here is just doesn't belong to the Sutta Pitaka. It belongs to the Abhidhamma or later Pali text. When applying the supermundane treatment to speech, action, and livelihood, the Mahacitarasika Sutta uses a string of terms that does not occur in this way in other discourses, while the strange string of terms is found in the definition of these three path factors in the Abhidhamma. Another noteworthy aspect of the Mahacitarasika Sutta's treatment of the path factors is that it reckons the mundane wholesome path factors as to be with influx, or this is what I was saying, these outflowings of the mind, sa-asavas, and ripening in attachment. This is a very good point here, because even these wholesome path factors, like right thought, the right speech, right action, they say they always are with asavas and they ripen into just a good rebirth. The way the Mahacitarasika defines these mundane path factors corresponds to the definition used in other discourses where these path factors are part of the Noble Eightfold Path that leads to the eradication of dukkha. So what it says, just if you look at the right thought there, thought free from lust and ill will and from cruelty, this is called mundane right thought, which yields worldly fruits and brings good results. The Eightfold Path leads to Nibbana. So there's actually a very deep contradiction there, which Analia brought out. You know, if you do the right thought, it's supposed to be the Eightfold Path. It leads to Nibbana, not just worldly fruits and good results, yeah, but also leads to Nibbana as well. The path factors are part of the Noble Eightfold Path that leads to the eradication of dukkha. Thus, what other discourses reckon as an integral part of the path to liberation, the Mahacitarasika Sutta treatment considers as something that is with asavas and ripens in attachment. This mode of presentation shows the influence of the Abhidhamma type of thought, as works like the Dhammasangani, that's what the first one of the Abhidhamma, uses a qualification without influxes and with influxes. So that actually term comes from the Abhidhamma, and only for the four paths and fruits and for the unconditioned element. From this perspective, any other type of experience, however wholesome or conducive to liberation it may be, we reckon to be with influx and consequently to ripen an attachment. Comes from the Abhidhamma. At this point, the question could be posed to what extent the Mahacitarasika Sutta's overall exposition requires a treatment of the supermundane path factors. What has it got here, supermundane? According to the preamble, this is a great point, the preamble found in the Chinese and the Pali versions of this discourse, the main intent of the Buddha's exposition of this discourse was to show the supportive function of the other path factors for the development of right concentration. If you actually look at the beginning of the sutta, it says, this is how these first seven factors support, the jhana. That is the central point at stake. The central point at stake was not to present the path factors individually, but rather to show their interrelation as a basis for developing right samadhi. To bring out this point, the supermundane treatment of the path factors would not be required. Hence, from the perspective of the central topic of the discourse, the treatment of the supermundane factors does not seem to be indispensable. In other words, it is dispensable. There's no real point it being there. The same treatment shows distinct Abhidhamma characteristics and vocabulary, and that particular part of the sutra is absent from the Majjhima Agama and the Tibetan parallels. This suggests the treatment of the supermundane path factors in the Pali version of the Mahacitarasika Sutta to be a later addition. Perhaps an early commentary on this discourse considered the path factors from supermundane perspective of path attainment what originally was only an alternative mode of explanation, preserved in oral commentary, was later absorbed into the discourse itself during the process of oral tradition. So that's a reading out from an earlier. I think this work now, Pali Discourses on the Light of the Chinese Parallels, is actually in the library if you want to see it for yourself. But it's pretty clear, and a very strong argument, that all this difference of mundane and supermundane does not apply. The supermundane part of this was actually added after the time of the Buddha, which makes much more sense. Yeah. Okay, yeah. It's because the word can mean either. It's, you know, from Sawa, because it can be a-sawa or a-sawa. So in the compound, when you put it together, it can mean either. It means flowing in or flowing out. And it was either one fits the Pali. And it's just really a matter of a person's preference. And actually the flowing in, inwards, does not make as much, it's not as meaningful to me as flowing outwards. Because, you know, you're a meditator and you're sitting there and you know that's your home, and sometimes the mind does go out there into the world and goes out there to play. So the idea of going out is much better, I think. It's, it really starts to show what the mind does.
The point of information, the Chinese translate that as low, which means a house.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. A leaky house. And as, because there's not much said about these middle factors, Vedanyana Tiloka also mentions this other part, which is, again, every factor. They say, no, in understanding wrong thought as wrong and right thought as right, one practices right understanding. And in making efforts to overcome evil thought, to arouse right thought, one practices right effort. In overcoming evil thought with attentive mind and dwelling with attentive mind, possession of right thought, one practices right mindfulness. Hence, there are three things that accompany and follow upon right thought, namely right understanding, right effort, and right mindfulness. So again, that's not really meaningful. But the main point is to remember that this right intention is important, even though it's only very short. It is make sure that when you have moments of consciousness, the best you can, make sure they're free from trying to attain something or get something. To be thoughts of letting go, thoughts of kindness, and thoughts of gentleness. And then you do very well in your meditation. Just make peace, be kind, be gentle.
Two places that are very short,
yeah. Indeed, yeah. Now we come to right speech. What now is right speech, the third factor? Herein, someone avoids lying and abstains from it. They speak the truth. They're devoted to the truth, reliable, worthy of confidence, not a deceiver of men, nor of women. Being at a meeting or amongst people or in the midst of his relatives or in the society or in the king's court, and they're called upon and asked as a witness to tell what they know, they answer, if he knows nothing, I know nothing. If he knows, he answers, I know. If he has seen nothing, he says, I have seen nothing. And if he has seen, he answers, I have seen. Thus he never knowingly speaks a lie, either for the sake of his own advantage or for the sake of another person's advantage, or for the sake of any advantage whatsoever. So this is very easy to understand. It means telling the truth. But there is even more than that. Obviously, if you are, suppose you're put in a situation and they have this old saying in Tibetan Buddhism, suppose that you are sitting meditation under a tree and this person ran by you and say, I've been wrongly accused of seducing someone's wife, and the villagers are after me with machetes, and they're going to kill me. I'm going to climb up this tree, and if they come past, don't tell them that I'm hiding in the tree above you. And so he climbs up the tree, And a few minutes later, the villagers come with their machetes, really anger, waiting for blood. Have you seen that seducer of my wife? We come to kill him. He deserves this. Have you seen him? And what does the monk say? If he lies, he's broken his precept. If he tells the truth, an innocent man is going to be slaughtered. So, what should he do?
You can always eel wriggle.
Eel wriggle? Is that lying? That's a good. I do not see that scallywag in front of me. Is that lying? This is deceiving people, isn't it? But is that lying? Actually, because this, for the monks, it's one of the rules there. They say, if it's actually what you're saying is the truth, you know, it's that, you know, I can't see him. You know he's up there, but I can't see him. And then, again, because you're telling the what is actually the truth, it's not really breaking the precept. So as long as it's actually factually true. And one of the examples of that, which is in our forest tradition, there was this monk in the tradition, one of the Kruba Ajahn, Ajahn Singtong. I went to see him. He's a very, very funny monk. And I don't think that all monks, these Thai monks, are all serious. He was hilarious sometimes. He just really cracked jokes. He was a very, very funny monk to be with. But also, very strong samadhi, reputed to be enlightened. And when he was practicing with, I think he was actually practicing with Ajahn Mahabur once, and he was late for alms round. I know, was it for some morning chanting or something? I think for, no, it must be for alms round. And so what he did was he managed to catch a wild chicken in the forest. He tied a string around the poor chicken's neck and dragged it to the hall. It was clucking behind him. And then when Ajahn Mahabur saw him coming and said, "You're late. You shouldn't be late." He said, No. I came before the crow, or before the chicken, which is a Thai idiom of actually saying you got up really early. And Ajahn, all the monks burst out laughing. And Ajahn Mahabur is really so serious. He just gave in and said, "Okay, you win," because he was very clever. But it was a lie. They asked him afterwards, "Wasn't he lying?" He said, "He wasn't lying, because he was deceiving. But he actually did come before the chicken." Yeah. That's the lesser of two evils idea, which is valid. Yeah, but there's also just there's other ways of doing this. And I remember somebody told me that during the Second World War, I think this was in Holland, where Anne Frank was, there was a fellow, a very high-minded fellow. I think he could even be like a pastor of the church, and he was hiding some Jews up in the attic. And when this sort of the German Gestapo, whatever it was, came by. And they said, we've come to see if there's any Jews in here. Have you got any Jews in your house? And he would not lie. But he said, "Oh, come and have a look for yourself." And he said it with such sort of authority and innocence. They said, "Okay," and just went to the next house. They left him alone. And he wrote about that in the book. He didn't need to lie. But that was actually pushing his luck. But anyway, the actual word, as long as you actually tell the truth, then it's not really considered to be a lie. Remember, this monk came to visit our monastery years ago, and we were just finishing our meal, and so we asked him, "Have you eaten?" He said, "Yeah, I've eaten already, yesterday." "Come, stop it, come and have some meat, something to eat." He didn't want to bother us. But that's not real lying, although it is a bit deceiving. So the other point of lying, which is not mentioned here, which comes out in the monk's Vinaya, is deliberately breaking a promise. So if you tell someone, "I'll come tomorrow morning to help you with the meal," and if you break that promise, is it lying? And what they say, if it's intentional, if it's at the time, you make that promise and you don't intend to keep it at all, you're just saying it to impress someone, then that really is a lie. Or, you know, if you make no effort to keep that promise, yeah, I don't really feel like working the kitchen today, then again, that's breaking the precept. That is a form of lying. But if it's just you forget, or, you know, you really get caught up in jhana, or you've got to help someone else in some emergency. So in other words, you do break the promise, but it's unintentional, out of your control. Then it's not lying. So when I actually understood that, that made it very careful that if you do make a promise, don't make promises easily. If you're going to make a promise, make sure that there's a good chance you can keep it. So when you do make promises, you need to keep them. Too many people in the world, they make promises too easily. And they're very important things. So don't make promises lightly.
So the intention is at that moment that you're saying you're going to do something, you're not thinking of doing it, that's a lie.
Indeed, yeah.
Because intention is in the moment.
It's in the moment, yes. But even later on, when you make that promise, you know, consider it. You know, will you be able to keep it? So, you know, you don't make promises that lightly. You just, oh yeah, I'll do that for you. Without really consideration, can you or can you not? Will you? So when you make a promise, the chances are that you will keep it. So the promises are trustworthy. Next one, abstaining from talebearing. I call this malicious talebearing. You avoid talebearing and abstain from it. What you have heard here, you do not repeat there, so as to cause dissension. Now, that's most important. That's your motive, to cause either dissension. And what you've heard there, you don't repeat there, so as to cause dissension there. Thus, you unite those who are divided, and those who are united, you encourage. Concord gladdens them. You delight and rejoice in concord. It is concord and harmony you spread by your words. And this is where we tell tales just to break up sort of relationships, just to break up sort of the harmony in a place. So it has to have a malicious aspect there. You're telling a tale. Peter, you know what Sir Nicholas was talking about you, what he was saying about you during the interviews? Peter, you know what he was saying about you? And I say that just to really upset you. He wasn't saying anything about you, but this is what people do. And that type of like tale-bearing and gossip, which is malicious, that is really what it means. But, you know, if, you know, like Nicholas comes and tells me, oh, I heard Peter say he's going to commit suicide. And that's, you've got to tell me that so we can stop him. So, now, if there is something which really need to be said, you tell those tales. And it's not really telling, it's actually because it's from a good motive, a good intention. So that's why it's really malicious tale-bearing. Harsh language. You avoid harsh language and abstain from it. This is when you shout at someone or scold them. You know, you're stupid, you're an idiot. That's harsh language. Instead, you speak such words as are gentle, soothing to the ear, loving, and such words as go to the heart, are courteous, friendly, and agreeable to many. I really love that because, you know, people in the Western world, especially, they love blasting each other, scolding them. And I always found that's never the way to get sort of people to do what you want. So instead, you say, Nicholas, you're such a wonderful person. Would you mind so much if you were just, I know it's a big burden on you, but tomorrow morning, would you make my tea for me with condensed milk? And of course, you say that to him nicely. And of course he'll do it. If I say, Nicholas, tomorrow morning, get up early and make me that condensed milk tea or else. And then people don't like doing it. They say, oh, I'm not going to do that for such a rotten mug. Not everyone would. So like, using kind words is always the best way. So if you want someone to help you, or you need some assistance or something, say kind things to them. And this is, I don't know why he's got this here for the measurement number 21, but it's very good anyway. Even, O monks, should robbers and murderers and terrorists saw through your limbs and joints. This is actually with a two-handed saw, not with a chainsaw, that's too quick. Now, the two-handed ones in the old days, they used to saw backwards and forwards, through your leg, through your thigh, getting into your bones. If they would saw you, limb from limb with a two-handed saw. Whoever should give away to anger thereat would not be a disciple of mine, the Buddha said, would not be a follower of the Buddha, even if you've got one moment of anger to your torturers. That's a really tough one. That's a similar saw. So this, thus you should train yourself. Undisturbed shall our mind be. No evil word shall escape our lips. Friendly and full of sympathy shall we remain, with heart full of love and free from any hidden malice. And that person shall we penetrate with loving thoughts, wide deep boundaries, free from anger and hatred. So that's, you know, if people are actually sawing you up with a two-handed saw, okay, you should still be kind to them. You shouldn't sort of get upset at them. Now, if that is the standard there, no matter what anybody else does in this monastery to you, if they snore in the room next to you, that's no excuse sort of for having ill will. Even though they keep me awake all night with their noise and their snoring, still my heart will be friendly, full of sympathy, with heart full of love and free from hidden malice. So no matter if they don't turn up for the duties or they otherwise sort of upset you, there's no reason to have words of ill will or even thoughts of ill will. And then actually people do that. There's beautiful cases of some of these Tibetan monks who have been put in jail by the Chinese and tortured. And actually do that. Even though they know they're really being real heavy torture. And they say, no, you know, I will not allow you to sort of stop my kindness. And if they do come out with hearts full of love. It can be done. It's wonderful. It's impressive. So remember that whenever you get upset and want to sort of shout at somebody. And are you staying from vain talk? Vain doesn't make any sense to me, but what it means is, I would say, like useless talk. You avoid useless talk and abstain from it. Instead, you speak at the right time, not too often, in accordance with the facts. Speak what is useful. Speak of the Dhamma and the Vinaya, that's the law of discipline. So your speech is like a treasure, uttered at the right moment, accompanied by arguments moderate and full of sense. So in other words, if you speak too much, like anything else which is in large supply, it's valueless. But things which are very rare, like diamonds, they have high value. So when your speech is very rare, you hardly ever say anything, then people pay attention. My goodness, he's speaking. And then they will listen. So see if you can talk little at the right time, in accordance with facts, speaking what is useful, not to speak because you want to sort of vent. Speak of Dhamma and Vinaya. Then your speech will be like a treasure. That's right speech. Now it follows on. Sorry, yes?
So I think about being outside, so one speech should reflect aspects of Dhamma and Vinaya, and it's not called as such.
No, it's just what's appropriate at the right time and the right place. So even though the people you work with, they don't speak Dhamma, they don't speak Vinaya, still you should actually be kind to them. The right time, the right place. Now, mundane and super mundane right speech. Again, this is added to each one of these ones. Here's of two kinds, but it's not two kinds. I'm going to pass through this because I've already gone through that this is not part of the word of the Buddha's came from Abhidharma. There's no such thing as mundane right speech and super mundane right speech. All right speech is important. It's an important factor to the achievement of the super mundane. So it's a bit of a mistake there. And the same could join with other factors. In understanding wrong speech as wrong and right speech as right, one practices right understanding. In making efforts to overcome evil speech and to arouse right speech, one practices right effort. In overcoming wrong speech with attentive mind, dwelling with attentive mind, possession of right speech, one practices right mindfulness. Hence are the things that accompany and follow upon right speech, as with everything. Right understanding, effort, and mindfulness. Now, right action. Oh, we're not talking about politics and stuff. This is from the...
From the machine.
That's right, yeah.
Self-talk.
This is some right talk. This is actually from the Silawaga, usually. In the mind of a monk bent on speaking, they should remember this. Talk which is low, coarse, worldly, not noble, not salutary, not leading to detachment, not to freedom from passion, not to cessation, not to tranquility, not to heart and knowledge, not to enlightenment, not to nibbana. Then we talk about kings, or prime ministers and presidents, robbers and ministers, in other words, what's happening in the newspapers, talk about armies, dangers and war, about food and drink. Clothes, couches, gardens, perfumes, relatives, cars, villages, towns, cities and provinces. You'd actually say also these days sport, football, cricket. About women, wine, gossip of the street and of the well. Talk about ancestors, about various trifles, tales about the origin of the world and the ocean. Talk about what happened and what did not happen. Such and similar talk I should not entertain. In other words, you just don't speak about things which aren't very useful.
Puts the minister, the kings, robbers, and ministers together in
groups. That's right, yeah. I think the robbers, that must be the politicians. No, I can't say things like that. Okay, that's right. Speech, right, action. Kamanta, this is kama. Hearing, abstaining, what is right action? Abstaining from killing. Herein someone avoids the killing of living beings and abstains from it. Without stick or sword, they didn't have guns in those days, conscientious, full of sympathy, he is desirous of the welfare for all living beings. So that's actually the first precept. What about euthanasia? Suicide. Is that breaking your precept?
This one?
Yeah. Is the wrong action? Committing suicide? Really? You should have read that, because I wrote about that in the Enlightened Times.
Yeah, very good.
I
have a question about the list you just read.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, from what I can tell from reading the sutras, if you went up to the Buddha and you're like, hey, how about those celibates? He'd be like, I don't talk about that.
Yeah.
But what about, like, normal people? You know,
yeah, even the Buddha actually talked about kings. He talked about robbers. So what it's actually talking about it for a good reason.
Oh, okay.
So in other words, you're not just gossiping just for wasting time. So the speech is not just to waste time, have a nice conversation with somebody just to pass the hours. Because, you know, you come up there and you sort of watch me speak, and I remember watching Ajahn Chah speak. He would talk about the events happening in the world and local events. And that was a way of engaging people. And then he would sort of use that to sort of, as the Buddha said, he would talk about these worldly things. Then he would sort of get the conversation around to doing good karma and, you know, making sort of merits, being generous. And then he would actually, when the person was like softened up, then he would tell them the real Dharma about Four Noble Truths. He would soften them up, first of all, just by being courteous and talking with whatever they wanted to talk about. And that's what people do. So, yeah, kidding. And what about when you sweep and you catch an ant, or you tread on a snail? That is kidding, but it's not breaking these precepts because obviously it's not intentional. And even though you know that when you sweep the ground, you'll always catch one ant, even though when you drive the car, you'll always smash one insect on the screen. Well, like when I was in Christmas Island, and the crabs were out, and it was impossible, it really was impossible to drive down the street without squelching a few crabs. And even though I told the driver to be careful, the poor fellow was trying to do his best, swerving all over the road. But he couldn't do it, it was impossible. The point was, as long as your intention, you know, was to try and avoid killing things, that was fine. Well, then, if it's possible, just go sweep somewhere else. Just leave them. Just think of doing it the next day, because they don't stay there forever. That's what I would do. But, you know, sometimes if there's crabs, I mean, they're all over the whole island when I was over. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's just no way you can avoid it.
Well, what is, like, you know it's going to happen, and you kind of, you know, like if you do something, and you know like there's going to be a lot of stuff which is going to die.
That's right. But what is your intention? Are you...
I just hope no one's going to die.
Yes, but as long as your intention is actually not... The whole purpose of that pushing the button or that intention is not to kill. It's some other intention. So the intention of sweeping is not to see how many ants you can kill today. The intention of sweeping is actually to get the leaves off the path. The intention of driving down the road in Christmas Island was actually to get to the talk. It wasn't to sort of see how many sort of crabs you can squash. So what the intention is really important. What are you doing this for? So you know this intention here is actually to drive the monks, you know, into the, say, to see the doctor, and even though you know you're going to squash some insects on the way, you know, that's not what you're doing there.
I've been called to military service. I still have to do it. I hopefully get out of it. But you know, like, if I have to go and do it, you know, otherwise they're going to put me in jail. Would it be better for me to go and push the button? It might kill some, you know, a lot of ants and
stuff. Actually, this is what people ask Ajahn Chah, because they're in military service, saying, he said, no, if you've got to do that duty, so you go and join the army. He said, make sure that when you go to the firing range and you practice shooting, make sure you really put a lot of skill into shooting so you can shoot accurately. And then when you go into battle, because you can shoot accurately, make sure you weigh them over their heads.
Yeah.
That's what he used to say. If you don't shoot accurately, you don't know where it's going to hit.
So, suppose you're doing a cleaning job.
Yeah.
And you see a mark.
Yeah.
Too late, you realise that actually it's an insect.
Yeah. Then there's no offence at all. It's not breaking the precept, because that wasn't your intention. But you know, if you just get really fed up, these ants all over the place, smash.
Yeah.
That's breaking the precept.
Even though you feel you can just be a bit more mindful.
That's right. So next time, it does actually say there, you're desirous of the wealth of all living beings. So, you know, next time, be careful. Yeah. Yeah,
One story I had was my cousin, he's an idiot, he's in the army in the United States, but he was a sergeant and he was involved in the American attack on Guatemala, is it? What was one of these conflicts they had?
Oh yeah.
He got
that's a long time ago.
No, not so long.
Was it Haiti or something?
It was in the '80s.
Oh yeah, that's
what's his name, you know, pineapple face.
Panama. Noriega, Panama.
Yeah. Maybe it was Panama. He got decorated because his unit didn't fire a bullet. Because most of the casualties at that time in the American side in that conflict were from injuries that were, you know, friendly fire. And his unit didn't fire a single bullet.
Yeah.
He got decorated for, you know, they had a...
Saving money.
No, they had the self-preservation to not fire whenever there was fire.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Kind of thing.
Okay, it's very good.
The self-discipline to not
that's very
shoot
good.
When there was something
to be lost. Great. That's excellent.
So even the army can reward.
Yeah, that's excellent. Well done. So the next part of our action is abstaining from stealing. You avoid stealing and abstain from it. What another person possesses of goods and chattels in the village or in the wood, you do not take away with thievish intent. So it only says what people own. What if you actually steal, say, from the cat? Now, what happens if you're really hungry one morning, and, you know, you sort of, you know, you fancy that chicken which somebody's left for Emily or for Hammer, and you say, let's waste it on a cat, I'm going to take it myself. Is that stealing? According to the Vinaya, the answer is actually no. They say animals don't have rights of property, according to here. So if you see a monkey with a hoard of bananas, you can take as many as you want. Monkey might not be very happy, but... No, I don't think the animals think they own it. But anyway, that was the anomaly which was in the monk's Vinaya. So they said, no, if you sort of steal from a monkey or an elephant or something, it's not considered to be stealing. Yes, but what about honey? Aren't you stealing from bees?
If you're very gentle. Well, I've been teaching.
Yeah.
That's why I gave it up, because
of how gentle.
One of them
would
get into your...
No, you're not making the piece of that. Yeah, you had a question? Okay.
I don't know that phrase from non-killing. That little section passage, it seems to go a lot further than that, to include like harmlessness.
It does, yeah, but the actual precept is actually steal, is killing, but it adds extra. But you should be desirous of the welfare of all beings.
Why wasn't harmlessness included?
Because it's just the precepts are just like rough guides, and have to be practical. Because unless you're an anagami, it's very hard to be harmless. Now, the next one is an interesting one. Abstaining from unlawful sexual intercourse. This is the third precept we have. You avoid unlawful sexual intercourse and abstain from it. And this is what unlawful sexual intercourse is. You have no intercourse with such persons as are still under protection of father, mother, brother, sister, or relatives, nor with married women, nor female convicts, nor lastly with betrothed girls. It says nothing about having intercourse with married men, male convicts, or even betrothed men. In actual fact, if you look at this carefully, only men can break this precept. It's actually true, it says that, isn't it? Because it's just the way it was put. It was all about men having sex with other people's women, and nothing about women having sex with men. So, technically, no women can break the third precept. Nevertheless, the spirit is that none of you should have intercourse with such persons as are still under protection of father, mother, brother, sister, or relatives. So this is an interesting precept, this. When people actually talk about it, you say it is actually culturally specific, because in some cultures, the age of consent is 18, some 16. And depending on other cultures, even lower than that. So in some cultures, it's actually the protection of father, mother, brother, sister, or whatever is actually a legal thing. So this is one of those precepts that the same act in one country is breaking the precept, and another country is not breaking the precept. It's weird, but that's what it says.
The unlawfulness, Ajahn, is this, I mean, I guess in the old days it's like cult custom law or something.
Yeah.
Is that an indicator of where people's suffering is, like when you get people?
I think it's those laws, as you know, being an ex-lawyer, this is all sorts of conditions which make the laws as they are, cultural, religious, social, and what's actually needed by society at the time. But anyway, it's obviously that this is not having intercourse with people who are, if they're under the protection of somebody, it means they're sort of, they're too young. Or it could be that they are mentally disabled, that's why they've got protection. Or they're convicts or slaves or something. In other words, you'd say the same as not having sexual intercourse between teachers and students, which is really important. You know that many sort of lay teachers, even Buddhist lay teachers of meditation, they sometimes have sex with their students and get into all sorts of trouble. And that's actually illegal in many, many states. Any teacher, any psychologist, any doctor, they cannot have any sexual relations with their clients. If they do get those feelings, they have to break the teacher-client relationship, and then they can have a relationship, but not while they have that other relationship of a teacher to a student. So that would also be unlawful sexual intercourse, you know, like a teacher and a student.
Isn't
what about... Oh, sorry, go on.
Sorry, isn't this pretty widely spoken, though? I mean, kids having sex quite a lot nowadays?
Well, that's interesting. Is that sort of unlawful? Because I don't think... I don't know what the law is these days, but I mean, like if a 15-year-old boy and a 15-year-old girl have sex together, I don't think they're prosecuted, are they?
There's usually a spread, but...
Yeah.
You can have sex with someone under the age if you're within, like, 3 years of their age.
Is that a U.S. lawyer? Yeah.
Yeah. So
yeah.
Same age,
yeah. Yeah. 16 is the age of consent, yeah. But I don't think people prosecute if like two 15-year-olds. I mean, if it's like a 20-year-old has sex with a 15-year-old, yeah, I mean, it's obviously...
It's breaking the precept.
It's breaking the precept. Oh, well, is it breaking the precept? Because it avoids unlawful sexual intercourse, and it's very much to do with the culture of the time. That is why they had some of the Buddha's chief disciples, like King Prasenadi, had a whole harem of girls. It was unlawful, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, under the protection of the mother, father.
That's right, yeah. The protection of mother. To what age does that sort of extend? Over here in most places in the West, it's usually 16. Yes, my thing?
I think
Yeah, well, the intention is always the last when you have these sex things, but it's also just whether it's appropriate, whether it's proper. It's a lot of wisdom there to understand, you know, are you really exploiting this other person? So usually, if it is underage, one of the most important things is consensual. And the person is able to give consent, they're mature enough to give consent, and they're not sort of mentally unstable. So you can see it's a very interesting sort of a precept here, and it's not sufficiently explained, you know, by the Buddha here. But also I was going to say, what about gay sex? Is that breaking this precept? Yeah, indeed. So again, here it is, as long as it's not unlawful in that particular place, then it's not breaking the precept.
But there's still a huge potential for human misery when people interfere without being in relationships.
That's right, yeah. So you have to be, you know, consensual, wise, whatever. So the precept is actually broken. So you can get it pretty clear here. That when the people are underage, it's inappropriate because of the relationship you have. It could be like with parents with their children, or teachers with people under their protection. Those are all unlawful and wrong. Yeah.
What if like two, say some of these two people have been dating for like a year, but there's been like no talk of getting married or you know, whatever, and one of those people were to have sex outside of that relationship, would that break this precept or not?
It would not really break this precept because they're not really betrothed, but it would still be very unskillful.
Yeah.
So it'd be a wrong thing to do. Remember, just because it's a precept doesn't mean that's the limit of what you should do. It's as if like the precepts are the outer fence. So don't go beyond that, but you know, even don't go close to that fence because there's many potholes close by. Well, all the precepts, there's all the precepts are important, but the main thing is actually to be mindful, to be wise, to be kind, and also to have a mind of renunciation.
The first precept means actually just not to hurt anything.
Yeah, yeah, not to hurt anything. Not to hurt oneself, not to hurt others. So that's right action. Now, right action, I tell you, is of two kinds, mundane and super mundane. I won't go through that. Now, understanding wrong action is wrong action. Wrong is wrong, right is right, one practices right understanding. Making effort to overcome wrong action to arouse right action, one practices right effort. And overcoming wrong action with attentive mind, dwelling with attentive mind, in possession of right action, one practices right mindfulness. Hence, there are three things that accompany and follow upon right action. Understanding, effort, and mindfulness, as before. Where is right action about abstaining from drinking alcohol? It's not in there. Yes. But anyway, it's obviously wrong action. Okay.
But let's say people that are very deluded,
yeah,
and they make, it seems, where their actions have less bad karma because they haven't come in contact with teachings such as this, whereas another person would know, you know, they came across these teachings, they know.
Yeah, it does seem that way. Remember, the Buddha actually said about the law of karma, which is so complicated, only Buddhas can fully understand the law of karma. Even arahats, they can't fully understand it because it's so complex. So obviously it makes sense to me that, you know, the more knowledge you have, that will influence the effect of the karma. It's still bad karma, no matter what you do, but the effect of that, if you know it's wrong, will be far greater than if you sort of are deluded.
So like animals making, you know, lots of bad karma, they would, it's not too heavy, so they can still perform, let's say.
That's right, yes.
The human realm.
That's right.
And the people.
Your rabbit can still get reborn as a human.
The yoga
of the turtle, yeah. Hard. But if they associate with being human beings, then they obviously can. So the more they associate with human beings, sometimes the more they think they're a human being. And, you know, see these dogs or cats. Oh. Yeah, they will not eat anything except human food. Now, what is right livelihood? And again, it's an important factor of the Eightfold Path, but it's very little said about it. When the noble disciple avoiding a wrong way of livelihood gets his living by a right way of living, this is called right livelihood. Now, when it gets here, the Majjhima Nikaya, it is said to practice deceit, treachery, soothsaying, trickery, usury, this is wrong livelihood. That's for monks. So they've got right livelihood, wrong livelihood for monks and wrong livelihood for lay people, and the two are separate there. They don't really say much about wrong livelihood for lay people, but they do actually say, we've got the Anguttara 5 down the bottom here. 5 trades should be avoided. Trading in weapons, in living beings, that's being a slave trader, or like a pimp, in flesh, like being a butcher, in intoxicating drinks, like selling alcohol, and in selling poisons. And they also, the professions of a soldier, a fisherman, a hunter, even say like a prison guard is wrong livelihood. Yes?
This is kind of a technical question. If you raise dairy cows, if you raise cows with the intention of killing them for meat, and if you raise cows with the intention that they will be dairy cows, are those, I mean, which ones of those are wrong and which ones of them are,
Well, essentially, just raising dairy cows, obviously, for killing them is much worse than raising them for milk. But what I know is if you raise them for milk, they have to be in calves, so you have to slaughter the calves. You have to slaughter something anyway, even the dairies.
You can buy them and sell them.
I sell them off, yeah.
If you buy them, is that wrong language? No, if you sell them?
It's obviously, there's no such thing as black and white here, the really, really wrong or really, really right. There's all sorts of grades. So the more you can look after your animals and be kind and care for them, the better.
Okay. What if you send them to a slaughterhouse?
Yeah, if you slaughter them yourself, that's much worse than if you send them to a slaughterhouse.
Okay. Is this a bit like vegetarianism?
Well, even vegetarianism, as I keep on saying, whenever you see people grow rice, they have to kill so many animals in the ground actually to grow the rice.
I'm sorry, bad is it to send it to a slaughterhouse?
It's
I want to go to a farm and they bought these cows and I want to know if I should really tell them, okay, you shouldn't ever do this.
No, it's really up to them. It's not your role to tell them that. If they can sort of change life into something much better, it's much better, but it's not that bad in the sense that if you do it yourself, that you know that if you kill something yourself, it's much, much worse than you get someone else to do it.
Yeah, it sticks with you.
Sticks you, yeah.
Two personal anecdotes. One is an answer to this question.
Yeah.
I raised goats for milk and making cheese. And then my daughter raised one of the baby goats, which was a male.
Yeah.
And she fed it milk and everything. And then one day, you can't keep males.
Yeah.
So you have to bring it to the auction.
Yeah.
And the Italians like to eat the baby goats.
Yeah.
And so that was the end of my goat
life.
So what I'm saying is, it's a personal thing.
Yeah.
And then it will teach you something.
Yeah. It's a very sad thing.
I had to kill a rat, the second anecdote.
Yeah.
I had dogs.
Yeah.
I have dogs, and I feed them meat.
Yeah.
They like meat. So I went to a rabbit farm and buy the meat. And then I realized, well, they're killing it. I might as well take the rabbit home and kill the rabbit and feed, if I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
So I brought the rabbit home.
Yeah.
And I put the white rabbit.
Oh, boy, hell yeah.
The white rabbit down on the counter. And I took a sharp knife. And to cut off the head, this was when I was very young.
Yeah, yeah.
This was before she was born.
Yeah.
And you can't get through the fur.
Yeah.
And that was the end of dogs eating meat. For me, I fed them avocados after that.
Yeah.
The end.
Yeah, okay.
So it's a personal kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And you learn from these experiences that I'm a real vegetarian.
Yeah.
A real vegetarian means that when you eat meat, you spit it out without even, without knowing it's meat. You yeah. just know your body.
How can you do
that? There are very few of those.
But anyway, for lay people, it's very, very tricky because it's very hard to get a livelihood which is actually pure and perfect. So it's very difficult to do because there's always something involved in there. And even like with treachery, I mean, if you start a business, you obviously have to charge people more than it's worth to get your profit. So it's always difficult, but you try and lessen it as much as you possibly can.
I think you said in one of your lectures, you said the world is a jungle.
Yeah.
Suffering, and you try to get through it with as little suffering as possible.
Yes, right, you can't avoid it totally. But it's also important just for the monks as well, because it's a wrong livelihood for monks. And wrong livelihood for monks now is doing such thing as soothsaying, telling fortunes, reading palms, telling lottery numbers, and all this other stuff, or giving out medallions so you can get money back.
What about the one that, you know, the Tibetans, they do like, horoscopes?
Wrong livelihood. So very clearly.
It's
also that, but it encourages people's greed.
So a store owner that sells, you know, vegetables and other things, and he sells also beer?
Yeah.
That would be wrong livelihood.
It would be wrong livelihood, but it wouldn't be as bad livelihood as if he actually owned a pub.
Or if he owned a liquor store.
That's right, yeah. So again, this is why a lot of times there was, the good example was that there was this man, poor he was one of the head supporters of Wat Nanachar Chah a long time ago, and that he went up to Ajahn Chah and said, I would like to keep right livelihood, but look, I've got kids, I've got a wife, you have to catch fish, you know, to eat, that's all there is to eat. There were no vegetables in those days. You just could not be a vegetarian. When I first became a monk, there just wasn't vegetables, there wasn't fruit. Now, for vegetables, sometimes you used to eat leaves from the trees. And so he went up and said to Ajahn Chah, look, you know, I have to catch fish. And so what should I do? And Ajahn Chah said, yes, you catch fish, but not enough to sell, just enough to feed your family. And you have to kill those fish and bottle them to keep for the dry season. And in the meantime, I will teach you everything I know about herbal medicine. Because those days, the monks had to know about herbal medicine. There was no other doctors around. You had to look after yourself. So it's part of the Thai forest monks' tradition that you would learn from your teacher the different plants in the forest and which would treat which illness. So Ajahn Chah was an expert on these, as most of monks in his age were. So he taught this to this poor arm. Years and years went by, and soon I've never needed to catch any fish anymore. He made his livelihood as being a herbal doctor. And that was actually a wonderful way of actually just saying, well, you have to have a living, so if you kill fish, you know, you can't be perfect yet, but try and aspire for that in the future. So I tell people who do these things, there must be pest controllers or something, well, see if you can work away from that to make your livelihood more and more pure as you go on.
So, could you say something about Hiriyotapa,
that's again when a person, this is the shame and remorse, this is when you understand the law of karma, so you know there's going to be some karmic retribution for what you do, and there's a sense of like shame, this is the wrong thing which a person who's wise should be doing. So that's obviously needs enough wisdom to understand what's right and what's wrong. Many, most people don't have that Hiriyotapa because they haven't been really taught what's right and what's wrong. So because of that, the Hiriyotapa is something which guards you, which when you're about to break a precept, when you're about to do something which is going to harm something, you just stand back and there's the reaction there that this is the wrong thing to do, I just can't do this.
So you watch the mind for how it's recoiling from the action.
Usually it's for most people, it's a natural thing which happens. They just realize this is wrong, I just can't do this. Okay, and then we have here, right livelihood is of two kinds, mundane and super mundane, which is again rubbish. Control with other factors, as before, in understanding, as before, its right understanding and putting forth effort to keep right livelihood, its right effort, and having attentive mind, you know what's right livelihood, you have right mindfulness. So, three things accompany and follow upon right livelihood, right understanding, effort, and mindfulness. It's a shame there's not actually more taught about what right livelihood actually is. Because it is, it has lots of nuances, it's not black and white. In our modern life, sometimes like in an army, if you're the dentist in the army, is that right livelihood or wrong livelihood? You know, you're supporting an army, but you're lessening people's pain. So it's very, very complicated. So because of that, you just all you can have is general principles. But at least when you become a monk, you don't have to make any compromises there. So if you are a monk, your livelihood comes from good things. So you don't sort of start businesses as a monk. You don't try and get money from, say, evil things such as telling fortunes or lotteries or doing potions for people. So what now is right effort? Now we're getting to some more interesting things. Remember Vyama? And I mentioned in that talk that sometimes in the... I was actually in the Patimokkha, the Vyamati, this is making Vyama, is sometimes just standing in silence. So it's actually... And here we actually can find it. This is a very, very good description by the Buddha. There are four great efforts. The effort to avoid, the effort to overcome, the effort to develop, and the effort to maintain. What is the effort to avoid? Herein, the disciple arouses their will to avoid the arising of evil, unwholesome things that have not yet arisen. You make effort, stir up energy, exert the mind, and strive. It gives the idea of like too much will in there, and the right translation would be something. The way it has rouses his will, they use the chanda, which is arouses almost your preference. Chanda is like an approval rather than a will. And you stir up this heroic energy and you know, use your mind. Chittang Bhaganhati, exert your mind. Padahati, you strive there. And I give an example here. Thus, when you perceive a form with an eye, a sound with the ear, an odor with the nose, a taste with the tongue, an impression with the body, or an object with the mind, you neither adhere to the whole nor to its parts. In other words, you know, you see sort of a beautiful woman, you don't sort of adhere, wow, that she's really beautiful, or she's got nice hair, or you see some food there and said, oh, that smells nice. Actually, you don't sort of adhere to a whole or a part in a way in which even unwholesome things, greed and sorrow would arise if you remain with unguided senses. So you watch over your senses, restrain your senses. You find a lot of time, whether it's greed, lust, or ill will, it's always when you sort of see mostly, you know, only half of it, a part of it. And you only see sort of one aspect, you know, the taste of the food. You don't feel the stomach ache, which is going to give you afterwards. So this control of the senses, this indriya samvara, is actually where you use the effort to avoid these unwholesome things which will come up if you left your senses unguarded. And it said, possessed of this noble control of the senses, you experience an inwardly a feeling of joy into which no evil thing can enter. This is the Vyapajja Sukha. This is one of the great happinesses when you actually restrain the mind. But no, it's not Anavajja Sukha, it's the... Yeah, it's obviously called Abhayapada Sukha. Yes? Yes.
So this translation of giving your will and effort and strive, it just means mindfulness, preferred, and peace. And that's the...
Yeah. I'll give an example of how this chanda is used in other circumstances. If there is some decision of the Sangha to approve or disapprove of it, so all the monks have to meet together, discuss it, and we vote on it. It has to be unanimous. Otherwise we can't agree, say on ordination or any other decision we have to make. But if someone is very busy or they're sick, they can actually just give their chanda, which is, means they give their consent, their approval. Say, I just, you know, whatever you decide, I would agree with. That's chanda. So it's not like an approval. It's like an assent. It's the mind sort of joining with that decision. So chanda does not just mean will. It's more like a sense, yes, I agree with this. It's a preference. It's the usual word in that particular context is consent. So it gives like a... Sorry? Even consent?
So consent is if you like something.
And you consent to it, it means it really gets into you. So chanda and chanaita, you consent to actually avoiding it. This is what you prefer.
So in meditation and in the mindfulness, so our practice is okay to remember, well, we can't remember, mindfulness kicks in, to prefer and enjoy peace rather than activity, right? That's the chanda. And then sometimes a not skillful thing would be, oh, chanda, you have like mindfulness to get stronger, because sometimes the mindfulness is more working better than at other times. But we have to remember that we can't make this happen. The mindfulness and the chanda will just happen just as we continue meditating and the mind sees that peace is better.
Yeah, it consents to peace. It doesn't consent to...
And then it'll learn to always prefer the peace.
That's right, yeah. It'll become an automatic process, yeah. Sometimes, yes, one gets takes time for granted, doesn't make use of it.
Do you have any advice then?
It's just live in the moment. Mm-hmm. Think you're going to die tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Not tomorrow, the next hour. Not the next hour, the next moment. Mm-hmm. And then, you haven't got much time. You're dying, Dania. But please not during the range retreat, as I ask people.
I
know
it says here, adheres to the whole or to the part. This always confuses me. I've read other translations of it. Anyway, to keep me, especially in terms of the eye and looking at people, that yep. leads to delusion about, for example, lust would come from seeing a girl, or a boy, yeah. or a boy for a girl, and then you see it as a person, rather than see it as just four elements or something.
Yeah, no, it's just, no, you see it as girl, you see it as...
hair or something.
The food, no, the hair is the parts.
Yeah, quite.
The part of it, but the whole. You know, this is girl, this is food, this is movie.
So is the idea here, is the delusion of itself?
No, it's just that there's a delusion, this thing will bring you happiness. And so, now that which you really enjoy. And actually you see that, remember, there's like a young man. If you see somebody, you know, and a whole group of girls are like in a party, you go to the one which you found the most attractive, you keep looking at her. Mm-hmm. And then you go to the part of her which was attractive. And the other parts you would actually ignore. Even though she may have sort of really ugly ears, you know, you just wouldn't look at that, you'd look at something else. And that was just because you wanted to actually to excite yourself. You wanted to actually to get that lust coming up. So you'd be totally ignoring of all her faults and just go for the parts which would excite you.
So it's not to do with itself, it has to do with enjoyment.
That's right, yeah, just the mind just wanting pleasure. The effort to overcome. Actually, that whole story I told the monks that I sort of managed my last, whenever I saw a pretty girl, I'd always look for a spot, sort of a pimple or something. And I always find one, whenever, no matter how pretty the girl, I always had a pimple somewhere. And that was just, they're not perfect. So that got rid of a lot of lust. What? That just as a young man.
But isn't the Buddha saying to regard them like as family? Because like, that seems, and as a girl, if someone does that, it's kind of like ill will.
Yeah, but
rather than like, if it's a sister or your mother or your daughter, isn't
yeah, that's a better advice, but sometimes for the male, the idea of perfection was an important part of lust. And to actually to break that illusion of perfection, to see, no, they weren't perfect. It was really important.
It's just their perception.
Yeah, yeah. That's right, yeah. Just one of those perceptions to overcome. The effort to overcome. What now is the effort to overcome? There the disciple rouses the will to overcome the evil, unwholesome things that have already arisen, and make efforts to stir up the mind, energy exerts its mind and strives. It does not retain any thought of sexual lust, ill will, or grief, or any other evil, unwholesome states that may have arisen. You abandon them, dispel them, destroy them, and cause them to disappear. So the first one is to make sure they don't arise in the first place. The second one, if they are arise, to find ways of overcoming them, to getting rid of them. And it really doesn't say here exactly what you should do. They give an example down below. As long as whatever it takes to make sure that these, you know, bad ideas, whatever is going to hurt you, doesn't come in the first place, and if they are in there, what's necessary to get them out. And of course, you know, give lots and lots of teachings about that. You know, if you've got dullness, what do you do to avoid getting dullness to begin with? And if dullness is there, what do you do to overcome it? So those are like the two right efforts. And a lot of times, exerting will, you know, really what we understand as it just makes it worse. But anyway, nevertheless, they have five methods of expelling evil thoughts, and you know, will comes as the last one. The last resort. If, whilst regarding a certain object, arises in the disciple on account of it, even unwholesome thoughts connected with greed, hatred, and delusion, then the disciple should, by means of this object, gain another wholesome object. In other words, this is called substitution. So, in other words, that if you see sort of one object, so sort of, you know, dullness, you try and substitute that so with another object. Now, it's usually just a reaction to the dullness. You sort of substitute that by being interested in dullness. What is dullness anyway? So how many different types of dullness are there? So how does the dullness appear on my body? How long does dullness last? Can I beat my record to see how long I can be dull today? Whatever it is, you're substituting the will towards dullness to an interest in it. And of course, dullness becomes really interesting. And as soon as it's interesting, you're not bored with dullness anymore. So it disappears. Or you should reflect on the misery of these thoughts. Unwholesome truly are these thoughts. Blameable are these thoughts. The painful result of these thoughts. So if you think too much, how painful is the thinking? It just really wears you out. It gives you headaches. It's just a pain in the head. So when you see the danger, I'll just finish the first and do the questions. You see the danger in these things is another way of expelling them. A lot of times, many of the thoughts and the moods, we don't see the danger in these things. When we get angry at somebody, we don't see the danger. We think it's a good thing we're doing, telling them just how stupid they are. We don't see the danger. Or you should just pay no attention to these thoughts. Or you should consider the compounded nature of these thoughts. It's just candors. It's just, you know, these things just come this way. Or the last of all, with teeth clenched and tongue pressed against the gums, this is just like what we take as effort. You should, with your mind, restrain, suppress, and root out these thoughts. In doing so, these evil, unwholesome thoughts of greed, hatred, and delusion will dissolve and disappear. And the mind will be inwardly settled and calm, composed, and concentrated. This is the effort to overcome. Substitution, seeing the danger, ignoring, seeing the sort of compound in nature, like four elements. And lastly, the last resort is using the will. That's only if it's really, really bad. And sometimes it doesn't work. The other four are much more effective.
Yeah. First one, they say to avoid the arising of evil and wholesome states. To only do that, the mindfulness must be very strong. Because usually, it's so weak. I mean, it can't be so strong that let it arise, then we try to get up. But to do the first one, the mindfulness must be very strong.
Indeed, yeah. But actually, to help most of these ones. Most of these ones, that's why the effort here is actually a very refined part of the path. And it's almost just before the great mindfulness and the great stillness come up. It's not an easy thing to do, but with each of these different levels of unwholesomeness, you know, unskillfulness in the mind, you know, first of all, when people first start practicing, they've got huge amounts of ill will and lust and greed and all sorts of stuff coming up. And little by little, we actually do overcome these things. And this is actually just by many, many methods, even just by keeping precepts, associating with wholesome people, with good people. There's many, many efforts which overcome the negativity in the mind. Listening to Dhamma talks, you know, doing meditation, whatever. So these are just examples of expelling evil thoughts, and especially when you get to the more refined sort of difficulties in meditation. You know, you have sort of some sort of obstacle there, and you substitute it for another one. Or, you know, just, you know, you're thinking too much, or you're fantasizing, you reflect on the misery of these things. Or just pay no attention to, the thoughts of anger which come up. But these are just examples, and of course, in talks of myself and many other monks, we give a huge number of examples of how to overcome sort of unwholesome states which are in the mind.
It's the whole
path, yeah.
Okay. That's all you have to get, when you get rid of all that, it's all good.
And one of the ways of doing that, of overcoming them, is being making peace, being kind, being gentle. That also is a great effort to overcome. And it's also to avoid them, so these things don't come in the first place. That is actually the effort to maintain, I'd say, number four. Because they're absent, and you don't take the absence for granted, and it gives you lots of joy, so they're absent for a long, long time. Yes, Tanya?
Yeah. But then it actually gives a sense of ego.
It does, yeah.
The pleasure of it, but to see the danger in it, so substitute would just be okay, kindness, and then to see the danger in that kind of habit of mind, like what's the danger in that? It kind of like makes you, your mind unsettled. Can you just point out the dangers that our attention could go to so that we can see the danger of certain states of mind?
There's many, many dangers. One of the first things the Buddha said in the other suttas, to first of all see the pleasure of those defilements, because they are all pleasurable. There's a pleasure in sort of fantasizing or in lust, or in pleasure in getting angry. There's a pleasure in actually having grief and sadness. So there is a pleasure there. If there wasn't a pleasure there, we wouldn't do it. But it's also a dangerous pleasure, because it like hurts you in the long run. It hurts other people. It wastes time also. And there was that one story, a famous monk, I won't say who it is, he's not in this monastery, but he told me that they used to do a 2-hour meditation every evening, and it was tough sometimes. And one day, instead of actually meditating on his breath, he had this beautiful sexual fantasy for 2 hours. He says his body never hurt at all, and he was sat absolutely perfectly still with no pain until afterwards. Sort of the meditation finished, and he thought, that was easy. But what if the senior monk had known what I was doing? And that senior monk did have psychic powers, and he had read his mind. And he came right up to him, and he thought, oh my God, what is he going to say? And this is our great monk's sort of first goal, their disciples were having sexual fantasies. He looked at him and said, you've just been wasting your time, and walked away. And he said that was a beautiful scolding, because he wasn't saying, you stupid monk, you know, don't belong in the robes, you've just been sexually fantasizing all this time, that's not what you're supposed to do. It wasn't scolding, he just actually told it as it was. You just wasted time. And that's one of the great dangers, you know, you do waste time. So that's one of the great dangers. And obviously it gets you into bad moods. You get into real world, it gets you sort of into lusting about things. So, you know, once you get into these things, they take hold of you. You're not in control.
And what's the fourth one? The third was ignoring?
It's like seeing the compounded nature of these things. So analysing them, basically.
Okay.
Yeah, at 5 candles, just 6 senses, it's just...
You're sending the box, like you get it closer and closer, what is it?
Yeah, and it falls apart, there's nothing really in there. And the effort to develop, number 3. So the first one is to avoid bad things. Second one is to overcome them if they got into your head. The third one is to develop them, develop good qualities. What now is the effort to develop? Here the disciple rouses the will to arouse wholesome things that have not yet arisen. You make effort, stir up energy, exert your mind and strive. So anything which is wholesome, like faith, like joy, like happiness. Here in particular, the elements of enlightenment, the bojanga, based on solitude, detachment, on cessation or extinction, and ending in deliverance, namely mindfulness, investigation of dhammas, energy, rapture, happiness is to be developed, tranquility, stillness, samadhi and equanimity. So we develop these things, we develop our precepts, we develop our joy, and we develop our renunciation. All these wholesome things we develop. And lastly, the effort to maintain. What now is the effort to maintain? Here the disciple rouses their will to maintain the wholesome things that have already arisen and not to allow them to disappear, but to bring them to growth, maturity, and full perfection of development. Bhavana. You make effort, stir up the mind, exert the mind, and strive. In other words, if you've got wholesome things, like joy and happiness, peace, just, you know, see what's necessary to maintain them for a long period of time. I gave an example to Daniel earlier. And they just mentioned here, this is extra here. Example, you keep firmly in mind a favorable object of concentration that has arisen, such as mental image of a skeleton corpse infested by worms, blah, blah, blah. But that's, you know, just one example of maintaining, and it's not a very good one either. Yeah, but it's just maintaining the happiness. Now there you've got the four right efforts. Basically, I usually put them all together. Whatever it takes to avoid unwholesome things, unskillful things, you know what unwholesome things are, if they're there. Whatever it takes to overcome them. And to arouse good states, and to maintain those good states. And of course, one of the best ways of avoiding bad states is to arouse good states, because they can't be in the same place together. So some years ago, I gave a simile of the wealthy woman who went to the temple one evening, and she had told her guard, please look after the house, there's burglars around, make sure that no burglars come into my house, and be mindful. And so she went to the temple. When she came back, she found the burglars had been in the house and stolen many things. And they asked the guard and said, I told you to be mindful. He said, I was mindful. Yes, I noted them going in. Burglar going in, burglar going in, burglar going in. I don't see them coming out again. So, no, jewelry going out, jewelry going out, jewelry going out. I was perfectly mindful. And of course, that's not the whole thing. You have to have the right effort as well. And the right effort in that simile is to avoid, prevent the burglars coming in. And the burglars are the defilements which take away your peace and happiness. Prevent the burglars coming in. So you have to know who the burglars are. And if they are in, call the police, whatever's necessary to get the burglars out. And of course, one of the best ways of keeping burglars out of your house when you're away is to develop your friends. Invite them in when you're away. And also that when your friends are there, to maintain them, keep them in the house by giving them beautiful things to eat. And then they'll stay in your house a long time. So that simile is like the four right efforts, you know, in a simile of like the house. You know, make sure that, you know, your house, you don't allow the burglars who steal your peace and your happiness and your joy. And if they are in there, see what's necessary to get them out. And again, one of the best ways to develop wholesome states and maintain those wholesome states. And then the unwholesome ones, they just can't get in. Four right efforts. Truly, for a disciple who is possessed of faith and has penetrated the teachings of the Master, it is fit to think, though my skin, sinews and bones wither away, though flesh and blood in my body dry up, I shall not give up my efforts till I have attained whatever is attainable by manly or womanly perseverance, energy and endeavour. That's called right efforts. And it's not really right efforts, because I tried that once. My story, only 18 years of age. Gone to my first, 18, gone to my first Waitsak and heard that story about even my blood dries up and my bones turn to dust. I did that, yeah, I went to my room. 40 minutes I sat. I broke my record. I was in agony and I wasn't enlightened. And my blood hadn't dried up either. I was just really miserable after that. So the Buddha can do that, but remember, it's just more wisdom than willpower. That's why it's a dangerous teaching. The effort of avoiding, overcoming, of developing and maintaining, the four right efforts, have been shown by him the scion of the sun, that's the Buddha, and he who firmly clings to them may put an end to suffering. So it's good actually to cling to the path. As the Buddha said in the simile of the raft, the raft is there to get you from one side of the lake to the other, to cross the stream of craving. But once you've crossed, you don't carry the raft on your back. You abandon the raft, but you don't abandon the raft until you've crossed the stream. So once you cross the stream, you can abandon the raft. So as far as the path is concerned, make sure you cling to the path, especially here, there's like effort business, until you've crossed, and then you can then go. But that thing happens naturally.
Is clinging maybe the wrong word? Because that actually valuing the path, right? Is valuing the path of understanding? You're not actually clinging,
because
the path is
not clinging. It is. It's actually clinging to the right things, clinging to letting go. Well, as I said in that sort of simile a few weeks ago, when you're climbing a ladder, you grasp and cling to the rung above you, and you let go the rung underneath you to get higher. And soon you're. That rung of the ladder which you once was above, you were clinging to, now you're treading on. And then you let that one go to go at the higher ladder. So as Ajahn Chah said, please cling to your precepts. Don't let them go. Later on, they'll become natural, you can actually let them go. But in the meantime, cling to your cushion, cling to the walking. So you've got to let go of the right things first. That's right, and a lot of times it's just what happens. A very beautiful simile, which I haven't done for a long time now, is somebody once told me, and it was actually an interesting question, why is it that birds, when they roost on a tree at night, never fall off? And you can actually see that, you know, those trees, they sort of move in the wind, backwards and forwards, and I thought, my goodness, if I lay down a tree at night, I'd fall off after 5 minutes. And imagine that bird, you know, does it stay awake all night during the storm? And they told me that actually the claws of a bird, when they relax all the muscles, that's when they close. The more they relax, the more stable they are. The more those claws close in. And in the morning, when they wake up, to get let go, that's the effort to open up their claws so they can fly away. So the more they relax, the more they cling. So what looks to us as clinging is to the bird is actually really letting go. There's a very beautiful symbol, because the more you let go, the more it appears to other people you're clinging to sort of this stillness and peacefulness. But you're not clinging to peaceful stillness, you're really letting go. The more you let go, the more the mind stays in one point and still. The more you try and put forth effort, the more you fall off. Yeah. Netama, Prasadi. Yeah. Anyway. Yeah, because sometimes people think you relax when you just go out to the pub and relax. Go watch the TV and relax. Yeah. Okay. So that is the sixth factor. And so those are some the heart of the Eightfold Path, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, that's 5 whole factors, but they don't get much attention. Usually the right view and the right mindfulness and the right stillness, they get the most attention, but still there's some important stuff in there. So that's why we go through them. And next week, we get the right mindfulness. Mm-hmm.